Welcome to a new episode of Panel by Panel, the show that dissects a single comic book panel from the last 85 years of comics history each episode. I'm Siskoid, and our panelist today is Chris Pine. No, not that Chris Pine, the real Chris Pine. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This is your very first podcast appearance, am I right?
Yeah, ever.
Ever. So you're going from fan to... Fan to voice.
Yeah, fan to voice. Fan to guest. I think that's probably my limit.
You don't want to get into this racket.
No. I've listened to Ohatmu. It does not sound fun after the recording.
And that's why Panel kind of exists, because it's always a short show, and I get to do the editing really quickly. It's like, there we go.
Right.
You know. All right, well, you decided to put yourself to the test. My randomizer had to produce a panel for you, for us to discuss today. So let's get to that randomized series of choices using my database of available comic book materials, which in the digital age is almost everything at this point. It might be physical as well. In this case, you'll see that I do have this comic in my collection. So prior to the recording, we did roll up a year, a month, a comic on the stands that month, a page, and finally, a panel, the discrete unit of comic book storytelling. In this case, we rolled the year 1992, the month of October. Among all the comics out that month, The Revolving Finger falls on The Heckler Number 2 by Keith Giffen, Tom and Mary Beyerbohm, and Malcolm Jones III, page 8 of 22. And panel 2 of 9, which you'll find in the show notes at fireandwaterpodcast.com, along with the full page context, perhaps some other goodies, from The Heckler. So was The Heckler at all on your radar?
I don't think I've ever had a copy of it, but it sounds familiar. So it may have been on the shelves when I was collecting. The 90s, my collecting in the 90s was a little spotty. I think towards the early 90s, I started to tail off a bit, so I wasn't grabbing as many new titles. And probably if The Heckler started probably pretty early, what is this, issue 2? So I probably didn't pick it up, but I probably saw the covers. It sounds familiar.
What about Keith Giffen? Were you a fan of his? Or I know he had like different art styles over the years. Some people like a specific Keith Giffen.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Keith Giffen. I probably didn't start out as a big fan because he's very complicated sometimes to get into as a casual reader. Panel layouts, the art styles that he uses, very expressive. And so it took me a little while to kind of, get his language. But once I did, I was a big fan. And I think the Justice League was my doorway into Keith Giffen, where I started reading that book because I followed J.M. DeMatteis. And then I started collecting more Keith Giffen books to see if that kind of humor and style and kind of sardonic wit carried on. And you can definitely tell, I think J.M. softened him a little, because I think some of his other work is a little more bristly. Maybe.
Like he's a bit of a bitter pill. Some of these things. For me, my access, I think, was Ambush Bug. And it may have been Legion of Superheroes type stuff. But by the time I got into comics, he was already doing this style. Like the earlier stuff where the characters are more doll-like, very different from the super close-ups and dark, deep shadows, and you're not even sure what you're looking at. But Ambush Bug was probably my real access into Keith Giffen and the humor element, and him writing, or plotting at least. And The Heckler is kind of a cousin to that, I feel. So, I mean, it ran for only 6 issues. It's normal that someone might have completely missed it. I call it the bastard child of The Creeper and Ambush Bug. But regardless, I don't want to give too much away, because we have this panel here, and it's a little mysterious.
Mysterious, I guess that's a good way to put it. It's a little nondescript.
All right, well, I'll let you describe it for our listeners, and then we'll get to discuss it to death.
I guess in this panel, we're kind of looking over the shoulder of a character. The pencil work's very thin. It almost looks like an outline of a person instead of an actual person, almost like it's one stroke. The colors are very basic. You have pink for the head, pink for the hand. They're wearing like a white shirt or a jacket, and they're reading a newspaper, or I would imagine it's a newspaper that only has one word on it, which is headlines, which it kind of makes me think of No Frills products. I don't know if you're familiar with those.
Yeah.
Just say cola, and that's kind of what it feels like. And there's a very sort of basic brown desk that almost looks like a cardboard box. There's really no distinct character to it or individuality to it. It just seems like a blank slate of an image, and almost like it's a drawing before you go back and you fill in the detail. And there's a word balloon where, due to the lettering and the way the punctuation is just a period after kind of a long sentence, in my head I heard it as like how, very monotone. It just, the way the lettering is, it just makes me feel like it's a monotone kind of speaking. And he says, I'm not going to do a Hal impression because I don't do impressions. But he says, I perceive this superhero called the Heckler to be an extreme expression of individuality, which I guess kind of makes sense when you look at the image, because this looks very lacking of individuality.
Right. It's machine lettering, and it's the same font as the headline, the word headline. So we're living in a world of a particular world where there's a genericness to everything, an unfinishedness to everything. So what's your basic appreciation for this?
My initial takeaway is that it just seemed very much like maybe it's a parody, because it doesn't seem like something that is a real world setting up this kind of nondescript image against the words where he's talking about the Heckler being an expression of individuality. So it made me think of, like I mentioned before, No Frills. It made me think that possibly the character himself doesn't really have an identity, almost like probably like a blank face. It just makes me feel as though there's this sort of individuality versus conformity going on beyond the panel that kind of made me look at it a little closer, because I wanted to understand why everything was so thin and basic in the picture without being able to see what it's set against. So I wasn't sure if this is like a character, like a Batman villain, where they decorate everything to the theme of themselves, or if it's something that they sort of infest their background with, where everything is this kind of basic desk and chair and person and headlines and just has a label and not really any depth to it.
Yeah, that's a good approximation of what's happening. And I think if I give a little more context, yes, the generic man has no face, and you know, like he's an outline essentially like this, and he's like a perfect Heckler villain in a way, because like he says, like he even admits the Heckler seems to be an extreme expression of individuality, and he's got like this crazy costume and like he's very elaborate. So for this character to be the opposite of that, and it's like a new take on good versus evil, like we've had in, I'm thinking of Kirby's Fourth World, where it's like freedom, it's not good versus evil so much as freedom versus fascism with Darkseid and the anti-life equation and all that. So in this case, it's another take. It's expression versus lack of expression. It's hard to define, because you know, but it's following the mainstream versus, like, it's a flattening out of culture versus specifics, general versus detailed. I'm thinking of my literature classes, because in the in English literature, world literature, Western literature, at least the neoclassics of the 18th century, they were basically taking off of all the Greek and Roman works that already existed, and they had this idea that there was a general world. When they wrote poetry about a sheep, that sheep represented all of sheepdom. Mm-hmm. And then you had the Romantics that came after, and that was about individuality. And to my mind, we're still in the Romantics era. We're still individualistic. We still believe in, like, that sheep in the meadow, that's a specific sheep. What is beautiful about that one sheep? That was the professor's example. That's why I'm using it. But it was about defining details and being individualistic. And so we're not following the sort of poetics and mechanics of poetry that the ancients were using. We're defining our own way of, and so you get like a lot of different kinds of poets. So that kind of makes me feel like that. Like the Heckler is the romantic, and the generic person is the villainous neoclassic character. I don't know. He's supposed to be every supervillain in a way. Or all of those masterminds in suits, all of those Lex Luthors, those kingpins. He kind of becomes that by being so ill-defined.
You're a lot more cultured and refined than I am, because I don't think I would have pulled art history from this. I went more into Keith Giffen because that's the only context I had. And I felt like it might have been a statement about his world of comics, where in the 90s there was a bit of sameness and everybody was chasing that same audience with the same type of characters. And I could see, you know, and my brain went to Statler and Waldorf when I heard the name the Heckler, which shows you where my brain goes. Your brain goes to art, mine goes to the Muppets. But I imagine Keith Giffen almost liked them because they threw jabs at, you know, the show, but they were also part of the show and they were always there in attendance. So it's almost like Giffen is in this world. He's not going to leave it, but he's going to point things out that he thinks is pretentious. Maybe he thinks are ruining the creativity of comics. And that's kind of where my brain went when I was looking at it.
That's an interesting point, because in the 90s, there was a lot of over-rendering. And this character here, this villain, is completely under-rendered, unlike the Image comics type art, you know. And even the Heckler himself is over-rendered. And by that point, I think it's that deep pools of black, et cetera, style for Giffen. But it's also a little more rendered than that, a little closer to what he did with Trencher at Image. There's a lot more detail. So there seems to be like a conversation. I don't know on which side he falls, but there seems to be a conversation about artistic styles. And in a way, his deep pools of black and super close-ups is minimalistic compared to the fashion of over-rendered straps and pockets kind of style. There's that in there. So that's a very interesting point. The Muppet analogy stands in because he's doing both styles. Yeah, I like that. Do you still see Giffen's style in this panel, even though he's purposefully moved away from it?
When I first looked at it, I felt like it wasn't very Keith Giffen-y. Mm. It didn't give me that. Because when I think of Keith Giffen, my brain goes to a page instead of a panel where you see nine panels, or he's got a very sort of direct kind of storytelling with the way he lays out a page. So it didn't click with me right away that it was Keith Giffen, although, you know, obviously I knew it was because you told me. So I wouldn't have picked it up if I just saw this image that Keith Giffen drew this picture, or at least did the layout.
Yeah, it does have that shape. Like, you can tell it's part of a nine panel grid.
Yeah, with the way that panel is, yeah.
But otherwise, yes, because I know it is, now I can see it. You know, like just like the way the fold at the elbow, the fold of the cloth at the elbow. Yeah, that's a Keith Giffen line. You know, the way the skull, because the character is bald, hair would define him too much. So the way it's kind of angular, that's a Keith Giffen head. You know, so there's things like that.
Yeah, now that you mentioned it, it's very Ambush Buggy.
Yeah, Ambush Bug has that. It's not a like circular. There are like bumps in it. So that makes it, you know, more like Keith Giffen. But that's because we know. I think if we saw this completely out of context, you know, we need to be like Chris Franklin or somebody, like an expert in what lines look like. But I see it, hindsight being 20/20. And within the image, I do find things that are not part of the story, but that are evoked. Like the suit is so brightly white that I feel like almost, it's almost giving him a sunburn, and that gives us that really pinkish skin tone, which is not the skin tone that we usually see in comics. And it's like a little darker, it's a little pinker. And because of the white, it seems to pop more. Maybe this pink, this pig pink, that's the color of pig, might be more generic than a more subtle peachy tone, I guess.
Yeah, which is kind of what I was thinking, that it was trying to stay basic with the colors and not do a lot of blending. And it didn't want to, even the desk doesn't look like wood. It looks like cardboard to me.
Mm.
It almost like it's propped up, and it's not a desk that has any kind of design to it or any color or any, even like where you'd see imperfections in wood, that's all gone. So everything just looks very one note color, no style. And the pink I just kind of bought into as being, this is before we can change it and make it a little, you know, start shading and changing the look of the skin and adding any kind of contours. This is just the one color we have. We have pink, we have white, we have brown, we have black, and that's his world.
Yeah, I didn't even, we presume it's a desk, but I was also like, what is this? What is this shape? You know, is it like the hood of a car? And that's a headlight in the bottom? Those angles, was it like a piano? My first thought was it's a piano, and I don't know why I think, well, I guess maybe where you'd put the partition. I just couldn't make it out. You know, obviously the full page will give us context on this, but at this point, it doesn't.
Yeah, it makes it look like a something that comes with an action figure that you put together that's supposed to be part of their set. So, and it's not, it's just like a piece of the backing that the figure came in that you can fold and make into something. That's what it kind of looked like to me, with the line in the middle and the line that looked like a drawer to me, but that didn't look like a functional drawer.
Yeah, a lot of action figures come with, you know, objects that are just like a solid color And today they do a better job with that. But, you know, when we were kids, accessories were just the one block of plastic of a certain color, and that's what it was. Kind of could feel like that. There's something about just, I want to talk about the headline.
Right.
Because what is he reading into this? And that's where it philosophically took off for me, because it's kind of 1992. That's, I mean, the internet does exist in some proto form, but it does seem to prefigure the internet that we know today. The social media, clickbait, where people are just reading headlines and nothing else. And this paper has nothing else but a headline that we can't, obviously, we can't read. Our culture or public opinion is all down to algorithms that are funneling these headlines that we want to see, that we're interested in, you know? Right. They use our search histories and sometimes something you set around your device to funnel things towards you. So, like, to me, the generic man becomes a sort of, you know, after the case, but becomes sort of warning about just reading headlines, not being completely informed and taking headlines at face value. And like he says, I perceive this superhero called the Heckler to be probably something he hates, or probably maybe something he wants, because he doesn't have it. We don't know.
Yeah, there's no emotion to that statement.
No, none at all. You're right. It's completely flat. In the same way, his opinion is flat, and he perceives something which is not the same as that thing exists. It's all perception. And again, those headlines, the clickbait, the way we were spoken to online, it kind of fits that idea. So obviously, Giffen wasn't actually riffing on this. He was more probably riffing on Image Comics, over-rendered comics. I mean, he did create Lobo as a parody of that style, of the anti-hero of the late 80s and 90s. So it's probably what he's aiming at. But I feel like the generic man sort of becomes more as time goes by and as we also only read the headlines. We also only read the tweets and don't click the articles. If he's evil, that is a certain kind of evil that we've come to notice more than probably in 1992.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I know when I looked at it, I was thinking more that it was, it's not provocative. It's almost in the same type as his statement. And he's reading the headline, but there's no connection to an emotion or to a feeling that it's trying to give you. So I got a lot of that out of it, where I felt like this is, you know, a world that is erasing provocative subjects. It's erasing controversy or discussion. It's just, here's your headline. Now have your breakfast. Now go to your job. And that's what that's the feeling I got when I looked at it. I wasn't seeing it as a warning, but when you stated that makes a lot of sense too.
Censorship, in a way. All these details are censored. We, the reader, see a censored image where we're not allowed to see what he looks like. We were not allowed to see what he's reading about, make up our own minds about his perception, whether it's right or wrong based on what he's reading, because we can't read that. So it creates like a character that is isolated from emotion, from facts, from, I mean, his sort of pinioned ears doesn't seem like a good listener, you know?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, he seems like to be out of context with the rest of the comic book world and maybe making up his own, let's call it an opinion, but it's a very, like you say, there's no passion in there. It's just a statement of fact, but also a perception, so not actually a fact.
Right, and because we're looking over his shoulder, it almost feels like he's controlling our perception as well, that he's only letting us see what he thinks is appropriate.
Oh, and I just noticed a pun. Headline, and we're seeing a head and a collection of lines that aren't nondescript. It's like head, line. Yes, this is right. What the panel is. You know, so you could have like a sort of, when they were doing like postmodern art, and just, you would have these paintings that just had the description of what was supposed to go on the canvas, and the canvas was actually empty. And that was, for a while, that was like the fashion in art galleries. I think there's maybe a probable on-purpose pun going on here. Like, Giffen is smart enough to be doing this on purpose.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense, especially the placement of headline, which isn't exactly at the top of the page.
Although at the top of the page would be the newspaper name, right? The newspaper name, headline, and then you'd have lead, and then, mm-hmm. and then article.
Like, right.
If we could go zoom in on that newspaper, I bet that's what we would see. I think even this comic, to start giving a little bit of context, I think issue 2 actually starts with a blank page that says splash page, And that's you know, so it's playing with those tropes of what we expect in a comic book and deconstructing it in the villain's world, because the heckler lives in the so-called real world of detail and expression and individuality. And then you have this character that's completely opposite. So on the site, I will be putting the whole page, and I'll put the comic book cover just to remind people of who the heckler was and what he looked like, because he's potentially not on this page, because usually Giffen did this, right? It's like you get a 9-panel grid, but it's like a discrete chapter. And then you skip right to something else and on another grid and another grid and another grid. So I'm betting, without looking at it, I'm betting this generic person, we're in his world on that whole page, and we don't see the heckler there. I'll put those elements at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Any last thoughts on this this was possibly a challenge when you get like a sort of minimalistic panel.
Yeah, when I first saw it, I envied the people who got refrigerators. Because at least they could pretend to see condiments, and here we had nothing.
Maybe that is a fridge. We'll never know. Thank you, Chris. I hope you had fun with it.
I did. Thank you very much. I appreciate you inviting me on and giving me this opportunity.
Sure, and I'm sure you'll be back on possibly some of my other shows, because I don't like to waste guests.
I appreciate that. I don't like to get wasted.
Well, I'll let you go back to the margins. We'll listen to a short promo, and I'll come back with listener feedback on our previous episode.
Which is the hottest Marvel character?
Iron Man.
Ant-Man. I can't decide between Professor X and Magneto, so both.
Loki.
Is Wolverine Marvel?
What about White Tiger?
What about White Tiger?
Doc Samson.
Doc who?
Star Fox.
That's a video game.
The girls go on a journey to determine every Marvel character's hotness in Ohotmu or Not, the official handbook of the Marvel Universe podcast you didn't know you wanted. Available on iTunes and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
And now your feedback on our previous episode, which featured Daniel Ouellette and a panel from Punks the Comic number 3, Comment by Comment. Well, we just had Chris Pine on the show, and he just discovered the program because of the invitation. So here he says, I just finished binging the show, and I'm really amazed at how much I enjoyed it, because the premise seems impossible to execute. Yet, the idea of slowing down and examining one panel in the amount of time it probably takes to read an entire comic out of context really allows you to see stuff you probably gloss over when following the narrative of the story. What this show has done is show me how sometimes I tend to forget how everything in art, of any medium, is usually purposeful. What you see is supposed to be there, and skipping the details can rob you of some enjoyment. Not being someone with an art background or much knowledge, it was always interesting to hear people discuss the panels from an almost technical point of view and covering some symbolism and allegories. It was also fun to get a more layman's kind of interpretation that didn't dive too deep in each color choice or brushstroke. There was a lot of really fun moments in this run. I felt like I could actually hear Shag's eyes roll as he got stuck with a slaughtered goat when all he wanted to do was see some whales, and there's probably a gambling website somewhere that has odds on the next appearance of a fridge. Also, where else would you hear the phrase, attacking the chicken ferociously? Just an all-around unexpected fun thing to listen to, and these episodes have been funny, interesting, and informative. As far as the latest episode, this one is wild, and for some reason it makes me think of They Might Be Giants. Great band. Love They Might Be Giants, Chris. Specifically, a moment in the song Snowball in Hell where they sample dialogue from a self-help organization tape during the bridge. Connery looks pleased more than anything else with what's going on, and when you get to see the rest of the page with the toothbrush men, the panel of judges, and some of the Baldwin brothers, it all makes sense and really clicks. I'm kidding, it's bonkers. But I love it and now feel that like I want to read the entire thing. And now Chris has had the experience of, you know, the impossible to execute podcast, and he acquitted himself very, very well. So it just goes to show, not impossible to execute. And then we have Paul Keen, who thought this was a fun episode, amazing to put together on such short notice. I had never seen Punks before, so that was interesting, and I loved your mini Dada comics. I don't get them, but that's the point, I think. Or rather, I think, Paul, the point is you put meaning on them. Of course, in this case, I think there was a lot of French verbiage. Some of them are in French, so yeah, it's harder to put a point across. But that point has not actually put across It is the reader who imposes it on the comic. I think Punks works kind of the same way. I also had a discussion with Paul about Tintin recommendations from the previous episode. And based on that, he will try Cigars of the Pharaoh, which is the third volume, but really the start of the continuity for the series. Before we go, we have to mention the Fire and Water Podcast Network Patreon page at patreon.com/FW Podcast. If you like our content, please think about making a one-time or monthly donation to help host all of these podcasts. And as ever, a reminder that if you'd like to do one of these short podcasts, drop me a line and we'll arrange it. You will be handed a comic book panel randomly and we'll put it up for discussion. My thanks again to my guest, Chris Pine. And until we refill that seat, the panel is open.